the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
First up, if you have a desk job, you may be very envious of my first guest. There are not too many working lives that have included sleeping out on Skellig Michael, fending off polar bears, or helping Tom Cruise to motorbike off a cliff. Usually when we have a guest on, it's easy to introduce them, but I'm not sure how to describe Mike O'Shea, owner of Work at Height Training. Safety expert, adventurer, entrepreneur, explorer, logistics specialist, movie stunt consultant. You're very welcome, Mike. So what's your answer if somebody says, what do you do?
That's an interesting question. I get asked quite a lot. I actually can't really answer it, to be honest with you. I call myself a chancer, really. You know, I just haven't got caught yet, you know.
I was going to say, how do you see yourself?
But yeah, you've answered it. A chancer who hasn't got caught.
And you were born in outside Killarney in Beaufort, and the family moved to Dingle. But at a very early age, you became really, really interested in mountains and the outdoors.
Yeah, I suppose it kind of came, a friend of mine when I was younger in Beaufort gave me a book called Adventure Stories for Boys. And it had everything in it from Chris Bonington climbing Everest and all sorts of weird and wonderful things. I remember reading that when I was... What age were you? I think I was about 11 or 12 at the time. And I was just fascinated with that stuff. And then I joined the U Club in Beaufort when I was 13. And that was the first time where I got to abseil and climb, and that was it. I was just hooked. By the time I was 14, every weekend I was either out walking or trying to rock climb. And at that time, which you can't do anymore, but I mean, at that time I joined Kerry Mountain Rescue.
What appealed to you most about the mountains? Was it a bit of an adrenaline thing about climbing and a bit of a rush from that? Or was it just a sense of space or a sense of achievement?
I think a lot of it for me, I suppose, I got into a lot of rock climbing and ice climbing and paragliding and stuff out of it. Like, so for me, I suppose there's a huge amount of it was the adrenaline part of it, you know, for sure. And I think a lot of it is camaraderie too, because I mean, you know, I've been on the mountains with so many great people over the years and lots of good friends and built up great friendships. So I think I get more out of being with the people than necessarily, you know, what it is, you know.
What was it like the first time you saw really big mountains, beyond really big Kerry mountains?
I think, yeah, it was in the Alps, really. I went to Grindelwald and I was sitting under the Eiger. I was camped under the Eiger. That was my first big experience. We climbed two mountains at the back of the Eiger. I mean, yeah, the Eiger is the place you want to go, like, I mean, because it's just so sheer and it's so vertical above your head. Like, it's just absolutely amazing. But yeah, I think, for me, the sense of awe is like you're looking at something that's so big and then, you know, you try and climb it. And, you know, you get to the top and then you have the reverse look of it, you know. So it's, I suppose that's a big part of the adventure. It's part of the challenge of, you know, the physical challenge, the mental challenge, the planning, the organisation and stuff like that. And yeah, I think for anybody, hill walking or mountaineering is a great way to get that, you know, get camaraderie and also, you know, learn a lot of life lessons as well, spending time with those people, you know.
Did you have any really hairy moments when you were...
Lots of hairy moments, unfortunately. I've had lots of good moments and lots of bad moments. I remember, you know, there was an instance, I remember when I was about, I'd say I was about 19 or 20. No, I was even younger, I suppose I was about 18, 19. And I remember getting myself stuck on I had split from the two guys I was with and I had gone off a slightly different route because I thought I spotted a shorter way to get up this kind of very, very steep.
And where were you?
I was down in Kerry, actually. And I remember I had got myself up onto a ledge and I couldn't get out of it. I'd made the move across. The guy that was with me couldn't make the move, so he backed out. I had made the move and then I couldn't reverse the move. And now I'm stuck under an overhanging section of rock face and trying to get out of it. And it was actually, I think, the first time where I really understood fear. I actually puked from fear. And that is honest to God. And, you know, it took me a long time to actually admit that to people that I had done it. But I had actually got myself into such a stickle that I actually, like, remember vomiting on the ledge.
How long were you on the ledge?
Oh, I was probably there 15 minutes. One of the lads went to the top and he kind of spotted it. He could see, I couldn't see the route out, whereas he saw a route from the other side. So I ended up having to climb sideways and get out and get up that way, you know. So, yeah, I mean, that was an incident early in my career, and it was a good learning lesson, you know. It's just like, you know, yeah, just, you know, make sure if you make a move one way that you can get back out of it again, you know. But it was a big life lesson for me, you know. And it was a big life lesson on, you know, just trying to plow your own route and not necessarily listening to the people around you thinking that you know better. And then, yeah, you get yourself caught out, you know. So, you know, I was lucky that day and, you know, I was able to get out of it, you know.
And have you had that was terrifying because of what it might have meant.
Yeah.
Have you had any bad falls?
You might laugh at this. I was probably one of the worst falls I had was actually in Dalkey Quarry. I'd spent like 6 weeks or 7 weeks climbing the Alps, and we'd done like, you know, the hardest routes you could think of on the back of Mont Blanc and on the Mont Blanc to Tacul, some really, really difficult, like, you know, 23 pitch climbs that took like 17, 18 hours of like climbing at like top level stuff. And I came back to Dalkey and I was on a really easy climb in Dalkey and I actually fell off it. I think I'd come back from the Alps and I was just a little bit cocky with myself as well, you know. I probably fell about 25 feet, but I came down, I came down vertically, and just as I came down, I hit a ledge with my 2 feet. And then flipped upside down. I was actually looking into the eyes. I was right beside the guy who was belaying me, you know. So good job he was holding the rope well. But I was actually upside down looking at him, and I basically had to be carried out. He managed to get me out of the quarry, piggyback me out. And I ended up turning back up in Kerry in a pair of crutches and a cast.
But there was no sense of, I might just not do this anymore.
No, to be honest, there never was. I mean, like I've always, for me, that I'm always afraid that if I do, you know, when something happens that I'd stop. Because, I mean, I remember trying to fly off a mountain down in Kerry.
Fly off it?
You with a paraglider, yeah. And when I went to do the first takeoff, when I crashed during the takeoff process really badly, and I actually really knocked the wind out of my socks, like, you know, I really hurt myself, you know. And I remember just lying there going, I've got to just get back up and do this again straight away, because if I don't, I'm probably never going to fly again.
One of the things you were really drawn to as you got a bit older, more experienced in climbing, and you wanted to do more adventures, was ice. Traversing, you know, ice caps, going across Greenland, North Pole, all of that. What kind of draw did that have for you? Why that?
You basically leave with your gear, and you're looking after your gear, you're looking after yourself. You are fully responsible for everything you're doing, you know? And also just, you know, I think a big part of these trips for me as well is the planning. I love the planning part of it. I love the planning, the logistics, figuring it all out. Simple things like your toothbrush, like we either break the toothbrush in half to make it lighter or drill holes.
It gets down to that.
Yeah, drill holes in it, pull the labels out of your clothes. All the food, we decant the food out of the bags that's in because they're too heavy, and we put it into lighter bags.
Because on those expeditions, are you dragging? Are you using dogs or are you hauling it?
So for the Greenland crossing, we did a dog trip, but for the rest of the trips, we're actually hauling the stuff ourselves. And you could have up to 120 kilos inside one of those sleds. So every kilo adds up, you know, so you're trying to, you know.
How do you train for that?
Basically, you know, it's made, a lot of it, we just pull tires. We just get on the ground and just pull tires and just drag tires.
Where do you pull tires?
Tommy's Woods. Did a lot of stuff in Tommy's Woods in Killarney, Inch Beach. I made a little special sled for myself, a little steel sled that I can put weights onto so I can change the weights.
So if somebody was out walking in Tommy's Woods with the dog, they might see you pulling tires.
In the past, yes, they would have seen me dragging tires around Tommy's Woods and Orange Beach, or even around Dingle. I mean, I just drag tires around Dingle and different places. So it depends. Like when you're going on an expedition, obviously.
Make it sound like it's up the main street.
Not quite, no.
And when you're on a trip like that, you're not necessarily alone. You wouldn't do it as a solo. You'd have a companion or companions.
Yeah, I mean, some people do it solo. I mean, for me, again, it's back to this. You know, I like to have I certainly like to have a bit of company, even though you might not be, you know, you probably don't talk to each other all day because your face is all covered up with balaclava. And
would you end up getting sick of each other?
The tensions can build up for sure. Yeah,
over what? We're going to go this way. No, I think we'll go that way.
No, it's not. Yeah, I think when you're with somebody all day long and every day, and it, you know, it depends. To be honest with you, most of the people I've travelled with have been very good. Now, I've certainly been on some trips where we've had what we would call as a trouble child, you know, within our grouping, you know, and that happens, you know. But I think that's a really important part, is you really need to spend time with people before you go away, like so.
But what would you look for in a person as a prospective companion on a trip like that?
I think you just, like, one is compatible. You know, you've got to be able to get on, you know. You've got to be able to get on, and they've got to have the skill set that you're working on. So it's a big part of it is the training, is training together, so you understand, like, simple things like putting up a tent. I mean, like, which is fine out in the field and you troll around the place, but you're doing that in Greenland or you do that in the Arctic.
I've had more rows with people putting up tents, and it wasn't on the ice in Greenland.
We would always try and work together and put systems in place. So basically we would have a way of putting up the tent, you know, and you get into rhythm after a couple of days with that, and it's trying to get into a really good rhythm. So one, you can do it really fast, and certainly if it's windy, like in Patagonia and in Greenland, I mean, the winds are horrific, like, you know. And you know, people have died in Greenland where their tent was blown away, you know.
Well, what's the food like? What can you bring? What do you eat?
It's all about waste. So like things like, we just say, one of the things we used, I certainly love on the road is cup of soups. So when we'd stop at the end of the day, we'd just get the kettle on, someone would put the kettle on, boil some water, cup of soup and Pringles. That would be my kind of little treat. And then, you know, like, but you know, there's even...
And like, it tastes like they never taste anywhere
unbelievable.
Else.
Unbelievable, yeah. Well, it's great because the cold doesn't affect those things, you know. Because if you think of even going, like, we have to cut everything up in advance. So basically, the big part of getting ready is getting your food ready. So like a chocolate bar or a Mars bar, you need to cut that into pieces. Because if you think about it, if you catch a Mars bar and you put it in the freezer, which is minus 18, okay, or minus 20, your freezer, we're in temperatures double that and sometimes more. I've been down to minus 50 something. But the food is frozen. So like if I have a piece of chocolate, I need to put it in my mouth and melt it first before I can actually eat it. So it takes there's a bit of effort when you're out
Ridiculous.
During the day just eating, you know.
So let's say you're out there, you're in the middle of Greenland and you're halfway to the North Pole and you're with a couple of companions and... One of them is the, as you say, the troubled child, and it's not working out.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
It's very difficult. Like, to be honest with you, any of the really extreme stuff I wouldn't go unless I know somebody really well and I've already travelled with them, you know. It's trying to figure out who can communicate with that person, you know, because, you know, some people are going to get on with it, other ones are not. It's trying to get them to communicate with it. But I think, you know, once you've discovered there's a problem, it's always too late anyway, you know. So it's just a case of muddling through until you get to the other end. But, I mean, certainly I would be... Like a lot of the polar stuff I've done, I did a huge amount of stuff with Claire O'Leary, who's great, you know, traveling companion, you know, very, very strong, very resilient. And then I've been on other trips where, you know, I've been with the trip we did to Greenland. It was a mix and match of different people because we jumped onto the back of a trip that Borgi Ausland had organised. I'd always wanted to do dog sledding. And he had spaces left and he rang us up and said, look, I've got two spaces left. And he said, all right, I'm in, you know. And that was interesting because then you had a lot of people, a lot of people that were clients of his. Some very experienced and some with very little experience.
And what about the dogs? Did you find it very different dealing with the dogs?
I'd never do with dogs again. I mean,
why not?
I think I had this lovely Disney-esque idea of dogs, okay? You've got to dig holes for the dogs. You've got to feed the dogs. You've got to melt water for them. I mean, melting the water would take 4 or 5 hours for the dogs, you know. There's a lot of work in dogs. Then you've got to get their food together, you've got to get them out, you've got to get them unharnessed, harnessed up again the next day. So there's a huge amount of effort in dogs. And as I learned on the very first day skiing behind dogs, I mean, you've 12 dogs that you're feeding, like the kibble to, there's some smell off them. I mean, they're fairly special. And you're spending like 10 hours a day just sitting behind these guys going, oh my God. Yeah. And then if you happen to, you know, because they're obviously, you know, going to the toilet as they're running. And if you happen to get it on your ski, you're in serious trouble because your ski stops sliding.
Not everything you're skiing on is white.
Yeah, no. So it's you learn to watch the dogs very closely and
not so glamorous.
No, it's definitely I wouldn't you know it's great for a short run where you're on them for an hour or two. But if you're out with like proper working dogs that are going hard for 10, 12 hours a day, it's tough. Like you know,
how did you get involved in the film business?
We've kind of over the years jumped in and jumped out of it quite a bit. We ended up working on going way back War of the Buttons. You know, we worked on that. We did all the rope safety stuff for that. And the helicopter scene, and it's a very hard industry. I found that, you know, we tried to break into it a couple of times. I could never really get into it. I got little jobs here and there doing different things, and then it was really Star Wars when they came to Skellig, because we had done the safety on Skellig for years and years. So I ended up getting involved, and it was off on the back of that one in Dingle. They asked me would I go to Bolivia with them up to the salt flats. So it was at about 12,000. I think we were 12,500 feet that way. Did the Bolivia job for them, and then it just kicked off from there. It was straight into Bond. It was on to, you know, I've just been all over the world with it since.
And,
you know?
And there was a shift there as well, because what would have started as rope safety became more about more general safety around stunts and stunt coordinating. But I want to ask you about Skellig Michael, which you are very familiar with, is an extraordinary place.
Someone actually asked me a question lately about a pub conversation about, you know, for me, where is the most amazing place you've been in the world? And I always say, like, I think the most amazing place I'm drawn to is kind of Argentina and Chile. It's just so fast, so wild, you know, so impressive. But I said the best place in the world is the Skellig. I mean, I've travelled the world. I'm out of the country, you know, 9, 10, 11 months of the year on the road. And I think the Skellig is just, it's so amazing.
There's,
it's
something about the atmosphere of the place. I went out there about 20 years ago. It was my fourth attempt to get out because the weather was always bad. I've been down there in winter, and eventually I got out. And what struck me about it was it would be an incredible place to spend one night on, because it would be a totally different experience. You've probably done that.
I've stayed there loads, I've been on for a week at a time, so... it's amazing. We stayed there in huts. We've also stayed in the lighthouse as well, it's amazing the evening when there's nobody on the islands and it's just nice and peaceful. All it is the birds. You go for a wander around the place, So it's got so many different facets to it,
Has it given you an admiration for those monks?
They were tough boys, I tell you, that's for sure. They were tough boys because, some of the places that we have found where they've carved steps into almost vertical rock faces and stuff, it's not part of the public stuff, it's for the South Summit and stuff.
They didn't have Mike O'Shea to do the rope safety.
Jesus, they were tough men. Some of the places they have actually, some of the routes they've actually got on that island, because you can, obviously you've got the side where the tourists come in. They had other access points on the island as well, where they just, they've carved rock steps and carved handholds into the rock. Amazing,
There was, with Star Wars and the filming on the Skellig there was some criticism of whether or not it should have been used as part of a movie set and what might have been involved with all of the people there, people like yourself. How do you feel about that?
To be honest, I've been involved obviously in Skellig for a long, long time, and there's a lot of people, saying it's, you're turning it into Disney and doing this, that and the other. That's an argument, in one sense. But then the other side of that is that it's also... created a huge interest in Ireland out of it, and the Skellig, obviously the Skellig is doing fantastic since, and the whole area of Port Magee and all that area around there. To be honest, we didn't have any more people. We had actually less people on the island the days we were there than would have been in by the public. We brought lots of equipment on, but it was all very tastefully done. It was all very, every piece of rubbish was picked up, everything was cleaned. And it wasn't like we were digging out big trenches and we were doing all sorts of, we were working within the environs of what was there and building little scaffold pods, if we were putting someone standing in an area. So from my point of view, I think, I don't know why we don't use, more of our heritage for that way of creating awareness around what we actually have from a heritage point of view in Ireland,
With the film business, you were moving more and more into safety, stunt coordination, that whole area. Worked on James Bond?
Yeah, does that? Yeah, so anyway, James Bond, it was interesting because I ended up jumping on that by accident. I ended up doing transport. I started out doing transport on it because the guy who was doing transport didn't do it. So they rang me up and said, look, will you come and do transport for 6 weeks for us? Just to get us out of a hole. I got home 9 months later, went straight to Italy and did picture cards. So one of my claims to fame, in the James Bond section that's filmed in Italy, all of the background cars, so everything you see, not the DB5s, but any of the other cars that are involved in any of the chases and the park along the streets and stuff, that's what we were doing. There was some of us, me, Keane O'Driscoll, Danny Doherty from Malin Head, there was a whole gang of us. So we gathered them all together and we went out and we basically did all these cars for it,
What a great job.
Yeah, it was mental. It was just mad. I suppose I've been really lucky in the sense, I suppose a lot of it comes from, I suppose, the work I've done over the years. A lot of people wouldn't know, like we say, the roof and the Viva Stadium. When they built that stadium, 2 months beforehand, they still hadn't figured out how they were going to put the glass roof on the top, the plexiglass, because you can't walk on it. So I was involved in that, and we came up with a system. So I had a team working on that for 2 years, providing a safety system for that. So I suppose we've got lots, and that then with helicopters. So I've done everything from marine coordinator to aerial coordinator, expedition leader.
And one job leads to another.
You get a team of people you kind of work with, and then I've got a gang of people that are kind of in the industry that will drag me along on any of their projects once they've got work for me,
One of the Mission Impossible films, Tom Cruise in Norway does this incredible motorcycle jump off a ramp over a 4,000 foot cliff and then parachutes. And I've seen it, and I've seen the making of it. And you were there for part of putting together ramp.
So I got asked to get involved. So basically, I designed the ramp, and then we built a test one in the UK, about 100 metres long. And then while that was going on, I went to Norway with a team. This was during COVID. It took me 2 days to get to Norway. 6 flights, because there was no flights. And there was no one on the planes. There was no one in the airports.
You had to put it together.
But I also didn't eat for 2 days because there was nothing open. It was mental, There was no food on the planes. There was nothing open at the airports. there was the hotels weren't serving food. It was the maddest time ever. But
what about Tom Cruise? Because it was during COVID, there would have been restrictions about it. But did you have meetings with him or did you talk?
I've been fortunate enough that during I've done three movies with him, three Mission Impossible with him. So we already knew each other from the previous one I had worked on in Norway as well. He takes a very active involvement in all of his stunts. I mean, he was involved from, you know, discussing the design to what we were going to put on the top of it.
And what's he like to work with from your perspective?
I find him great, to be honest. I actually just met him in London last week. I just happened to be on a site that they were working on and I was chatting with him. But I find him great, to be honest. I think intellectually he's unbelievable. I mean, he's probably one of the hardest working people I've ever seen in my life. My admiration for his work ethic is just amazing. Like, even with that stunt, I mean, the amount of training he did for that stunt was frightening.
I saw a program about that stunt, sort of a 15, 20-minute video. Yeah. And in preparation, he did something like 500 parachute jumps.
Oh, yeah.
And when it came to filming, he actually did the jump on the motorbike off the end of the ramp 7 times.
Yeah, yeah, in one day. He would have done it about 20 times because he had enough motorbikes to do it up to 20
times.
So
nobody was saying to him, do you think you've one more in you, Tom? The camera wasn't switched on for that one.
Tom wasn't the problem. Everyone else was the problem because we were all right. I mean, how the man... I mean, the amount of energy he has and the motivation and his meticulous, like his planning and his everything is just, I've never actually worked with anyone who has a work ethic like him. I've never in my life, and I've worked with a lot of people, you know.
One of the things that strikes me about your career is these contrasts, you know, starting out with film stunts and Mission Impossible stuff to mountain rescue and rescuing sheep off mountains. Have you done that?
You might laugh at me. Early in my business career, that was actually kept me going for 2 winters, believe it or not. Because if you think back to, if you go back, there was really good grants for sheep. The European Union were very healthy in the early 90s with grants. So when I started out in business, when I left Leavers and went full-time into kind of rope safety and guiding and stuff like that, I for 2 winters, we used to get 40 pounds of sheep. Which was huge. That was basically the grant the farmers were getting at the time.
And would many of them get in trouble?
Oh, we were just, during the winter time, like, and certainly into early spring. I mean, we would be, you know, we've gone and picked 10 sheep off one ledge, or we've, you know, you might go and get one, but it was a case of we just didn't have money for anything else and we couldn't generate money any other way. So rescuing sheep was a very important part of my career for a while. It actually kept the fuel in the car and it kept the food on the table, you know.
Had they a bit of vertigo, or did they just jump onto the wrong spot?
Dumbest animals you ever met in your life. But you know, it's actually funny. It's one of the most dangerous things I've ever done. Like rescuing sheep, because the place they get themselves into is absolutely horrific. And you know, some of them are very docile and some aren't so docile. Like, so you can have it can be quite entertaining at times with sheep, you know. Yeah.
What would you say is the most dangerous situation you've been in? I mean, in the Arctic and that, there are polar bears?
Yeah, when you're going on a North Pole expedition, you are, and even Greenland and places, you are actually legally required to carry a firearm. So certainly in Canada, if you're going in Canadian or thing, you are actually legally required to carry a firearm with you. And there certainly has been incidents where bears have attacked, you know, in the past. But then, to be honest, I mean, we've come across bear tracks. I've never seen a bear. And then I was in Svalbard last year with Mission Impossible.
That's right up north. It's the island, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an island.
In the
Arctic Circle, yeah. I mean, there's more polar bears up there than there is humans. And I mean, there were some days we would see 4 and 5 polar bears, you know.
In those really freezing conditions, have you ever ended up in the water?
I've never actually ended up falling in the water, but we've trained for it. So we, you know, because it's certainly up in the Arctic and in the North Pole area is ice on water. So it's moving all the time and it cracks. We've had a crack where we're in a tent where it actually cracked right beside the tent, and our peg for the tent has gone over that way 2 meters, like, you know, when we woke up, you know, we heard a big bang and then got out of the tent and you're going, what's after happening here? And next thing you're after realising that actually the crack is right at the back of the tent, and the peg that's holding the back of the tent is on a piece of ice gone that way, you know.
From your travels north and far north, have you seen signs of change because of global warming?
Oh, huge, yeah. I mean, I think the amount of change in some places is huge. There's in South America, there's a place called the San Rafael Glacier, and that is a very popular cruise ship. Cruise ships swing in there to look at. You can see the front of the of the glacier falling off. But what was amazing, we had crossed the Patagonian ice cap and we were coming out beside that, okay? And over the years, somebody has been marking the rock as to where it was. And, you know, in the last, I would say in the last 20 years, that actual glacier has gone back probably 200 metres.
With dangerous situations you've been in, often crossing borders is where things can get a bit tricky, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose we've had lots of funny experiences with crossing borders where we've spent, you know, a day stuck at a border, you know, and people trying to get money out of you. But I mean, I think the weirdest experience and the strange experience I had was crossing from Brazil into Bolivia. So I had hired a car, got so far in a car, then I got a bus to the border. And then when I went to the border and everybody, you know, there's maybe, I don't know, 15 or 20 of us going across the border, but everybody was taken in and their passport was taken and they just waved me straight through the checkpoint. And I'm going, this is weird. So maybe they deal with foreigners differently. Went to the next checkpoint. They put me through that checkpoint. Still no one's touched my passport. I'm going, this is weird. Got a lift into the town and got a taxi then into the town. And it's the first time in my life I've ever left the town because I was scared. So nobody would talk to me. Everyone I tried stopping for a question, to ask questions, nobody would communicate with me. You could see people watching me, follow me. And it was like really, it was just really strange. And I left there, decided I was going to go back to the last town and try and come in here earlier the next day and get the bus out instead of staying there. So went all the way back. Same thing through the border, went through both checkpoints, never asked for anything. Came back the next day, same thing happened. I'm still scratching my head going, like, I need a stamp somewhere, you know, to get out. And anyway, jumped on the bus and I was meeting a guy in Bolivia who I'd worked with on Star Wars. He was picking me up and I couldn't understand why he wouldn't pick me up at this town because this is right at the border. So I'm on the bus for 32 hours, get to meet him. And I said, Marcus, why would you not pick me up at the town in the border? What was wrong? And he goes, that's the red zone. He said, nobody goes in there. I said, what's the red zone? And why didn't you tell me what the red zone was? And he says, that's where all the drugs are made. And that's where all the kidnappings happen. And that's where all the stuff. And I go, you never told me this. And he goes, I knew you'd talk your way out of it. That's exactly what he said to me. I nearly beat him.
Well, Mike O'Shea, stunt coordinator, adventurer, explorer and self-confessed chancer. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you.